This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. My chance to talk with artists, policymakers, and performers to hear their stories, what inspires their creations, what decisions change their careers, what relationships influenced their work. This hour, we'll talk with two actors, one with a legendary film career, the other who helped redefine television.
Thank you.
Earlier this year, I spoke with actor and director Dustin Hoffman as part of the Turner Classic Movie Film Festival in Hollywood. At the festival, we screen some of the greatest films of all time and then discuss them in front of an audience.
We decided to show this movie about Lenny Bruce at 11:30 in the morning. We're going to show Tootsie at midnight. We thought we'd mix it up a bit here at the TCM Festival.
In 2015, we selected Lenny, the 1974 film in which Hoffman portrays the groundbreaking but troubled comedian and social critic Lenny Bruce, who had died just 8 years prior of a drug overdose while battling ongoing obscenity charges. Lenny, shot in black and white by director Bob Fosse, was nominated for 6 Oscars, including Best Picture, Best Director for Fosse, Best Actress for Valerie Perrine, and Best Actor for Dustin Hoffman.
We're all the same schmuck. And it just cracks me up that we try so desperately to be unique when we're all the same. Cat Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, me.
When you make films like this, you've made so many great films and worked with so many great directors. Was Fosse someone, of them, was that a goal for you too, to work with Fosse?
No.
How was it to work with Fosse?
Tough.
Tough.
Tough. Bob was originally a choreographer. And choreographers don't have dancers coming up to them saying, what's my motivation? dancers do what they're told.
Right.
You know, he tried to be, in a sense, to collaborate, but it was tough for him, and it was tough for me. We had a tough time.
Did he like to do a lot of takes?
Yes, both of us did. The script, I thought, was problematic, so I wasn't that anxious to do it. We went into rehearsal with the principal actors, with the wonderful Valerie Perrine. Extraordinary performance. And with Valerie, myself, and, you know, Jane Minor, and I think Stanley Beck, we're in New York in a room, and it's going rough, the rehearsal. And after 5 days, we started on Monday, after 5 days, we're rehearsing routines, we're rehearsing scenes, and on Friday, Bob Fosse says, we don't have a movie, we don't have a script. See you on Monday. We rehearsed 2 weeks or 3 weeks, and we thought it was gonna be shelved. Went home and came back Monday, and he says, I solved it. And he interspersed it. He says, I'm going to intersperse it with interviews, because these scenes, there's no connective tissue to them. They don't connect. So Stanley Beck, who was wonderful in it, my manager, Valerie Pete, thank you. Stanley and I were close friends since we were beginning actors. And Valerie Perrine and Jan Minor are going, I think that's all it is, isn't it? Those three are going to be interviewed throughout the movie, and I'll have an easier time of shooting it.
Now, when you make a film like this, or any of the films you've made, I should say, do you have any kind of unique relationship or a specific relationship with the cinematographer, Surtees? This film was nominated for 6 Academy Awards, and in every one of the major categories you would imagine, Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor, Best Actress, Best Screenplay, and Cinematography for Surtees, who made his reputation shooting a lot of Clint Eastwood's films for many, many years.
Bob Surtees was one of the great cinematographers, Robert Surtees. He was the cinematographer of The Graduate.
Right.
Bruce is his son.
Is his son, right.
Yes.
Right.
No, we were good friends.
So you work with the father and son tandem.
Yes.
So when you shoot a film, do you have a specific relationship with cinematographers when you make a film, or no?
No, I don't. I don't want to know where the camera is in terms of... I do ask about lenses sometimes if I want my hands to do something. And I say, where are you cutting? Where's your bottom frame? Because if it's here, also I'd have to have my hands up here to have it in the shot. Other than that, I don't really want to know. It's interesting that you say that, Alec, because one of the things I objected to with Bob is that he posed me. And when you see it, it's gorgeous. So he was right and I was wrong. But, you know, I'd be up there and I worked so hard on these routines. I had never seen Lenny Bruce. Bob had never seen Lenny Bruce. Mike Nichols, who I talked to before I did it, because he'd done The Graduate, he and Elaine May were acting upstairs on Sunset Boulevard. Was it called the Duplex or something?
I don't know.
Nightclub. And Lenny Bruce was downstairs. And in between their acts, they would come downstairs and watch Bruce, because no comedian, they said, would do a whole show improvising. You know, sometimes you do 2 minutes, 3 minutes, and the rest is your stuff. But Lenny would come out and not know what he was going to say. I think the only two comedians I know since Lenny that do that, one was Rob.
Sorry.
One was Robin Williams. And the other one was a wonderful Billy Connolly. And neither of them, many times, would just go. And that takes a lot. What was the question?
We were talking about cinematographers and
you
posing.
So he would pose me, and I worked hard. I got the 33 RPMs that Lenny had made. That's what we called them then. We didn't call them vinyls. And I'd lay down on the floor, and I would play. I had about three months, and I did every, I wrote down longhand every single line he said in all the records. And he, even the ones he did over, he would always deviate, and I would write them down, and then I would go to Bob Fosse, and I'd say, geez, I like what he did here, because he used these sentences or he used that. And I was promised, and I think that's what I got so upset about, that I would be able to shoot it. We were going to shoot it, and I think that's what Bob wanted. We were going to shoot it in different clubs in Florida and with live audiences, and that's what I wanted. I want to be able to really feel like I'm doing it with a real audience, and you'll have, whatever, 3-4 cameras at once. He agreed, and that's what we were supposed to do, and then it's probably money wouldn't allow it. So it was quite laborious sometimes to do these routines over and over again, and he would tilt the camera. He'd be like where you are, and I'd be on the stage. He'd say, okay, now look a little bit this way, now look up, now look down. Okay, now do the routine from here to here. And, you know, it kind of broke my heart, because I was trying to be the guy. You know, Fosse was a great, great artist. And it's funny, because I just saw a film recently with that Alfred Hitchcock directed with Cary Grant. And Cary Grant said he'd never work with Hitchcock again after the first picture, because they didn't get along, because Hitchcock didn't like to collaborate. But then they made up and they made more movies.
But you say that Lenny Bruce was not someone you had been a fan of or had awareness of before the film, or you had?
No, I was in New York. I just never saw him. We couldn't have, before I was successful, we couldn't afford to go to nightclubs,
right.
You know, it was expensive. And I love it, the jazz is what's so extraordinary. I was next to you. Jazz never dates. Jazz is the same now as it was then. It was,
beautiful score.
Oh, and I had time. I had never seen him. I had never seen, I don't think, any comedian. I didn't go to nightclubs much. And I went out to L.A. because someone said to me, if you want to know Lenny Bruce, you got to go see Sally Marr, his mother, who was alive. And I went. She was very friendly. She introduced me to one of his best friends who we used to shoot up with. And he, in turn, introduced me to friends of Lenny. And I had a tape recorder, you know, like a Wallace, not a Wallace, like a Pearl tape recorder. And I taped everything, and she says, you want to go to Vegas? Because they're all there, all his friends, Buddy Hackett, other people. And I said, oh my God, yes. And I was taking all these notes. It was the best time of research I ever had. They all said the same thing, except Buddy Hackett. They said, you know Broadway, Danny Rose, that thing that Woody Allen did, you know? And they used to get together, the comedians, Lenny and these guys, when they were, you know, certain, whether it was, I don't know, Cantors or... and they said they'd sit around and do what they did in Broadway Dinner, you know, tell jokes. And they'd suddenly look around, and Lenny was always very quiet. And suddenly he's gone, because he was a shy guy, apparently. And he's gone, and they look around, they don't know where he is. And then they find him in the kitchen, talking to the people that work in the kitchen, the help. He loved to just talk to the people and ask questions and find out stuff. I think he originally, this is the stuff I had heard, they kind of say it in the movie, the musicians were more important to him than the audience. Because when you do show after show after show, if you notice, the musicians are always sitting like that, you know, because they...
Racing with the moon.
Yes, I know, I saw you do that. Of Vaughn Monroe. and Lenny felt that if he could crack up the musicians, then he was getting somewhere. I think he wanted to be in Hollywood. He wanted to be an actor also, I had heard.
You shot this movie where?
We shot a lot of it in Florida.
The nightclubs, the stage work?
Yeah, one nightclub, basically, I think. The scene when we're sitting next to each other, the scene up there where I'm in my raincoat and...
And you pointed out to me.
Yes. When I came back after my 3 months, I had all this stuff to give Bob. You got to put this in, you got to put that in, you got to put that... And the one thing that he kept was that scene. And the reason he did is when I was memorizing... It was this is before the kind of media, you know, you had cell phones and all this texting. Some guy heard I was doing the movie, and he had been a student somewhere in Chicago, and he sent me, found out my business address in New York, and he sent me a cassette, and I played it. Word for word, it's that scene. And I got pissed off at Bob, because when he shot the master from upstairs, right, in the back, and when I saw it, I said, you didn't cut in. He says, no. So that's 8 minutes, you know, of being up there just in one shot.
One shot.
And again, he was right.
It's nice of you to admit that, actually. It's very generous.
I admit a lot of stuff 40 years later.
Now, but do you think in your, I mean, obviously you're someone who, when you, I mean, I don't believe anything I read, but I mean, me of all people, I really, I try to minimize that in my life if I can, but for you, obviously, you know, very fastidious and very, very, lots of questions and lots of seeking and so forth in the work you were doing. And what do you think that comes from in terms of all the films you've made from Graduate on into Cowboy and everything like that, where you just seem so, what's the word? I mean, you're so...
Jewish.
Is that it? I'll convert if it's that simple. I'm going to convert tomorrow if that's what's going to get me into your stratosphere. But the thing is, you just seem like you always have something to prove.
Yes.
A lot of people got where you got, and they did what you did, and you scored with these performances and the originality. But then you keep going, and you still feel like you have... Did you feel that way? You still had something to prove again and again and again? What drove you?
I guess the same thing that still drives me. Kobe Bryant was... interviewed recently. It was before he, you know, had to step out for the season because he hurt himself. I saw the interview and I wrote it down. I told my son Jake, it was basketball. Same question, you know, all these years of great basketball playing, and he still spends so much time practicing and playing, whatever. Why? And he said, I guess for the challenge of every day. It's a beautiful sentence.
I have only one slight personal connection to Lenny Bruce, and that is that Marvin Worth was a dear friend of
yes.
mine. He died in 1998.
The producer.
He produced this film. He produced Malcolm X with Spike. He produced a lot of great... And he was Bruce's manager. And Marvin Wirth, who was from Brooklyn, and his wife, Joan, they were from Brooklyn, and he had one of the heaviest New York accents
I've ever heard in my life. His voice was down here. He had a very heavy accent like this. And he said to me, I'm going to revive Lenny on Broadway, and I want you to play Lenny.
I go, what?
And he said, I got 1,000 hours of tapes of Lenny. I got Julie and Barry. We got so much material of Lenny's. He said, there's so much stuff we can put in there. Now, don't worry about that. It's all going to work like a charm. And I go, and he goes, and you're Dusty, he called you Dusty. Dusty's not the only one who could play that part, by the way. He's not the only person who could play that part. I'm like, uh-huh, sure. And he goes, and I go, but what about the other thing? He goes, what other thing? I go, what about the other thing? He goes, what other thing? What other thing? What other thing? I go, I'm not Jewish. He said, you're from Long Island, right? I said, yeah. He goes, you're halfway there. The rest of it will take care of itself. Don't worry about it.
He would have been wonderful.
But when you did this film, how involved in your films were you before, then, later, in the casting?
Oh, I have to tell you, I'm glad you asked me. It's another example of Fosse's genius, is that I met Honey Bruce, which came first? He cast Valerie Perrine before he met Honey Bruce. And then he met her, and then I met her, not together. And I couldn't believe Honey Bruce, that Valerie was the reincarnation of Honey Bruce.
Oh.
Literally. I mean, it could have been like mother and daughter. And I said, Bob, you had to have met Honey Bruce before you cast Valerie. He says, no, it was just this intuition. I had nothing to do with any of the casting.
Except all your films, you were that way.
Oh, all of it, except Stanley. He was nice enough to have Stanley in it for my manager. In all my films, I mean, The Graduate, they've been trying for 2 years to cast it, and Catherine Ross and myself were the last two to screen test after 2 years, and I heard that they were sitting in the screen room, not particularly excited about our screen test, and I says, well, either we go with them or we don't do it, and it was that kind of a decision. That they've said that in interviews. I think Larry Turman said that, the producer. And Midnight Cowboy, he didn't cast John Voight. He cast someone else, and they wouldn't let him out of his contract. And after that happened, I said, please see my friend John Voight. We weren't close friends, but we had been off Broadway together. And he says, no, John Schlesinger said, he read for it, and he doesn't have that Texas accent. He was from Yonkers. I says, yeah, but he's an actor. He can get it, you know. And John immediately went down to Texas, forgot where, with a tape recorder, and spent whatever time, and came back and read for it, and he got the part. But he was second choice. Kate Jackson was the first choice for Kramer versus Kramer. She was in Charlie's Angels, and they were saying, oh, the film will pay back itself before we start shooting, because they were so popular. And then the studio wouldn't let her out. So I kept telling them about this Meryl Streep I had heard about. and they saw her. So there's been a few I've suggested. I've never demanded or, I don't think that works, actually,
yeah.
Unless you're directing or producing.
Well, some people they have these approvals of casting, and they utilize that in whatever way. And then there's other people who they just don't get involved. They just let that all take care of itself, and it doesn't really change what they do, you know.
Duvall and Hackman and I knew each other from the early days. They're much older. And
of course.
And we never worked together. And suddenly I'm doing this thing a few years ago. We're shooting in New Orleans, a Runaway Jury, and I have a supporting part, and Gene Hackman has a leading part in it. And the director finds out that we knew each other. We went to the Pasadena Playhouse together until he got kicked out after 3 months for not having any talent. And, oh my God, you guys know each other for all this time? 30 years, yeah. we got to do a scene. So they wrote a scene. It's one of the last scenes in the movie. It takes place in a public bathroom. It's like an 8-page dialogue scene. And afterwards, it was the last thing they shot in the movie. It's over. And Gene and I say, let's go out and get drunk. And we go to an Italian restaurant in New Orleans, and we're getting drunk. And Hackman says, were you scared? I said, I was so scared, man. I thought, yeah, I'm gonna forget my lines. He said he felt exactly the same way. You know, because you are what you are at the beginning. You don't really change. We were unemployed actors for 10 years. And he said to me, one of the great things ever said, we were this close to each other. He says, do you feel the same way I do after you finish a movie? And he probably had made 120 movies. I said, what? Do you feel like you'll never work again?
Yeah, of course.
Every single time. But yeah. That's it.
My conversation with Dustin Hoffman continues after the break. You can hear from other actors in the Here's the Thing archives, like Julianne Moore, who shares her special technique for getting ready to play a scene.
I'm very chatty. I like to talk all the way up to action. I do. And if you can't talk to me, I'm really disappointed. Then I get lonely. I don't want to be lonely when I'm working. Yeah. I want to be with my buddy.
Talk to me.
You're my friend. Let's be buddies. Talk to me. What'd you do this morning? What'd you have for dinner last night? What are you doing later today? Are you cold? Do you like that sweater? Do you like my sweater? What are you doing? Action. Acting. I love it. That's my favorite part. And then you get this great connection with another human being, and then the scene is like, poof, comes alive.
Take a listen at heresthething.org. This is Here's the Thing from WNYC Studios. This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. Dustin Hoffman has been nominated for the Oscar for Best Actor 7 times. He's won the award 2. Actors strive for depth and range in their work. Dustin Hoffman makes this appear effortless.
There's obviously roles you played, like Kramer versus Kramer, and all the President's Men, and you seem, I don't know what word to use, it seems closer to who you are, your voice and your appearance and the psychologics of it. You're playing a contemporary character. You're not playing somebody with some disability or what have you. It's not Rain Man or someone who's damaged and broken like Cowboy and so forth like that. But you've done both. There's a theatricality to the roles and a vividness to them, and you're not afraid to do that. Where does that come from? From being in the theater?
Yeah, I mean, where are you from?
I told you, I'm from Long Island.
Oh, you're from Long Island. You're rich.
I'm from Long Island. No, Long Island.
First of all, I wish we lived in the same city. How old were you when you started studying act?
22.
And when they sent you out, they send you out for certain kinds of parts?
Yeah.
Young leading men?
Yeah, young guys who cried a lot or whatever. Oh.
I'm the short Jew and still with some acne, and I come to New York in 1958 to study. And they always said leading men, young leading men, juveniles, character juveniles. That's what I was designed as. I couldn't get an agent. And that's just code for Semitic. You know, because in those days, the leading man was white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, and the ethnic person was a character juvenile or character ingenue. It really was that way. Anyway, so I went out a few times I could, you know, go to open auditions, because if you're not equity, then you can't go to a regular audition. And you can't go to a regular audition until you get your equity card. You can't get an equity card until you get a job, so, you know, catch 22. So the few times that I could go, it was the character juvenile. And by hook or crook, Nichols casts Catherine Ross and I in The Graduate, and I'd been just starting to get somewhere off Broadway, doing, you know, my own style of stuff. A hunchback German gay guy with a limp, you know. First thing that I got mentioned for in the New York Times, and Nichols had heard about it, and I got the screen.
You're not kidding. You played a hunchback, gay,
German homosexual. They called him with a limp. Ronald Ribman.
What was the production?
Harry, Noon, and Knight, and the other actor was what's his name? Joel.
Joel Grey.
Joel Grey. Sorry, Joel. Yes, that was accurate. So he brings me out to test me, and I didn't want to test. I was doing, for the first time in my life, doing well off Broadway. I won an award, and I thought, oh, I'll have a career. You know, I'll do off Broadway. And you know this as well as I do. You know, if God has said, look, Alec, you'll never be in the movies, you'll never get leading roles if you're struggling for years, you won't even be on Broadway, I will guarantee you a good part off Broadway for the rest of your life, you'd sign. You would.
Maybe, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so would a Hackman who moved furniture up and down, you know, six flights, and Duval who worked midnight to eight in the post office, and I was doing waiter jobs and a little acting, teaching if I could. And it's, you know, it's never changed. All, if there's actors here, you know the pain of that. Here he is now taking me out to LA and testing, and can we do anything about his nose, I remember. And I'm in, well, the guy is, he said, you don't, and he couldn't believe it. I mean, he's the hottest director from Neil Simon Broadway and also Virginia Woolf, he did. There was no hotter director at that moment in time. He was Spielberg. And he said, what do you mean you don't want to do this part? I said, I read the book of Mr. Nichols. It was on the phone. He's in LA, I'm in New York doing a play. I said, Benjamin Braddock in the book, he's 5'11", blonde hair. I says, it's Redford. I said, you don't want me. And he said, no. He says, I would like to test you. He says, you mean he's not Jewish? I said, right, it's Benjamin Braddock. And he said something I've never forgotten. He says, well, maybe he's Jewish inside. Years later, he's from Berlin. Mike, he came here in the early 30s, and he had his own pain because he didn't have a lot of hair. He had scarlet fever. And he not too long ago, just a few years ago, I read in the paper that he never understood why he cast me, and then he finally did through an analysis or something, and he said, because I was like an alter ego of him. He felt like he was me in, you know, on the periphery, you know, out of it, and he was casting himself, the funny looking guy. Do you know that that movie was shot, and I went back to New York to collect unemployment. It was a lot, because, you know, it's 50 bucks a week, it's getting the most you could get. And they're cutting the movie. Again, I read this in the newspapers. And Lawrence Terman, I think it was the New York Times, a producer, they're showing it all over the Bel Air circuit, Beverly Hills, Bel Air, Brentwood, on the movie theaters they have in the homes. And over again, Terman said, before it opened, and over again, people in the industry would come up to Larry and say, well, hey, brilliant film you almost had if you hadn't miscast the lead. And that was the perception.
You know, it's interesting because speaking of that casting thing, he and I have had a little, there was a whiff of my appreciation of his career. And you might not remember this, I doubt you remember this, but I go to the old Westwood Marquee Hotel because I get called to go and audition for the movie Hero. Oh. And Stephen Frears is the director, and the phone rings. And this is back when I was making films in the 90s and everything, and I'm lighting one off the other, and I'm going to meet this guy. And I'm like, I'm in my car. I'm like, God, oh, God, God, oh, God, oh, God. Mates, they're going to go to the Westwood Marquee, and they just lay out the facts. They're like, you know, snap out of it. You're going to go to the Westwood Marquee, you're going to meet Stephen Frears, and you're going to have a meeting with Dustin Hoffman. I'm like, I love this guy, I want to make this movie with this guy. And all of a sudden, like 20 minutes goes by, and Stephen Frears, now if you know the movie Hero, where someone commits this act, and there's a case of mistaken identity, and Andy Garcia played the other role, so there has to be this case of mistaken identity between the two actors. Stephen Frears, literally 20 minutes in, I mean, my dream is just taking flight. My wings, I'm flying over the Westwood Marquee Hotel, I'm gonna make my first movie with Dustin Effin Hoffman. And Stephen Frears looks at me and goes, you know, I just realized that you don't look anything like Dustin at all. And it was like, there I'm flying, all of a sudden, He shoots my balloon, and I crash onto Westwood Boulevard. I'm dead on the highway there. I'll never forget. You talk about, yeah. Our dreams, how they escape us.
It's but, now called the M, right?
Right.
Yeah, in Westwood.
But the exactly. When you show up and you work with Schlesinger and you do Cowboy, do you come up with all that and you show him? Did he help you? Did you?
Cowboy, very briefly. He didn't want. It's very similar to Frears and You. He did not want to see me because he had seen The Graduate. And that's the only thing he'd ever seen me in. And he was an artist. He didn't give a shit that I was in a big hit and suddenly an instant star. He wanted the right person, and he refused to see me. And I heard about this. And I had read the book. I thought the script was okay. It was Waldo Salt. He actually came in a room with John Voight and I when we did it, and he had a Wallensack tape recorder. We improvised everything. The Schlesinger was great at that, and he would go home, Waldo Salt, and write the improvisations into the scenes that he'd already written. Anyway, he wouldn't see me, and I said, please, I gotta see him, he's gotta see me, and he agreed. I know we're running out of time, so go quick. 42nd Street, what do they call those things where you go and you put the quarter in? I can't remember.
The Automat.
The Automat, thank you. And I says,
The Automat.
I'm going to direct a movie of him playing a car.
You all heard it. Go ahead.
And I used to go there, and we all did, 2-3 in the morning, whatever, and get coffee, whatever. And it was all kind of trance people there. And I said, I'll meet him in the Automat, and I want to do it about 1 or 2 in the morning. Because, and I'll dress accordingly, which is what I did, a kind of coat like I wore in that scene at Raincoat. And I didn't shave for a few days, and I greased my hair. I was auditioning. And I came in, and I just met him there, sat there, and he looked at me, and he looked at, sparsely crowded, people around. He says, yes, I think you'll do quite well.
So the voice and all of it, you just throw that out there. You come up with that.
Oh, you keep trying.
You got to meet my friend O'Daniel.
You're too kind.
Where do you find this?
You get desperate. But I didn't.
That's my problem. I wasn't desperate enough.
No. And we're rehearsing, and then Schlesinger has to shoot some exteriors before we start shooting principal photography, because he's got winter and he needed winter. So John Voight and I go, and he says, well, you don't have to talk. I says, I don't have a character, I don't have a voice. I said, I can't, I barely have a walk. No, we'll have the camera across the street. You guys just gotta walk. We're not starting for a month, but we just need the weather, the smoke coming out, whatever. Okay, so John Voight and I were walking, and John Voight and I knew each other for years. I was the assistant director, which is like, sharpening pencils in Off-Broadway when he was in View from the Bridge with Bob Duvall. He was brilliant. And he was an up-and-coming star. And we were competitive. Actors are always competitive. And, if you're walking down the street, you got a script, you have a reading, or you did the reading, you see another actor coming over, you've always put it behind your back. It's just something, because you don't want the competition. Anyway, so we're across the street walking, and says, all you have to do is walk. I says, yeah, but I'm supposed to cough. We're at that point in the movie where, you're going to find out he has TB or whatever. He says, yes. Schlesinger says, all right, you'll do some coughing, do some not coughing, but you don't have to talk. I said, okay, I'm rehearsing out of panic, trying on these limps or whatever. And I said, this shouldn't be shooting. We got a month to go. I haven't found him yet. And suddenly we're walking and we pause and I'm trying to cough and I threw up. Literally on John Voight's cowboy boots. And afterwards, Schlesinger says, I think we've got it. You do. And John, because he's an actor and, we're competitive, Schlesinger told me later, he went up to Schlesinger and he said, John, let me just ask you something. Is he going to do that all throughout the movie? He says, because I'm not even in the scene if he does.
Well, let me just say this, because obviously, I mean, I got another 45 questions I could ask, but they do have a schedule here for the festival. But I do want to say, I mean, as sappy as this sounds, on behalf of everybody here, I want to say thank you to you, because I really, from the bottom of my heart, you are one of the greatest movie actors that has ever lived in the history of this world. And you've done so many great films. Please help me in thanking Dustin Hoffman, everyone.
Dustin Hoffman has accrued a lifetime of knowledge about acting and the entertainment industry, and despite turning 78 this summer, he's now embracing a very new way to share it. He's teaching an acting class online. The description reads, quote, "Dustin teaches you everything he wishes someone had taught him," unquote. You can sign up at masterclass.com. Coming up, actress Edie Falco.
Sweeney Todd was one of the first things I saw where I thought, I don't know how, but I got to.
You did feel that way.
Oh, my God, that one show.
This is Here's the Thing from WNYC Studios. This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. Edie Falco played Carmela Soprano on the groundbreaking HBO show about an Italian-American mob family from New Jersey. Falco now has two kids herself, but when she was playing Carmela, she was a single woman living in New York. In this clip, we hear Falco with the late, great James Gandolfini, who played her husband, Tony.
You know what I don't understand, Tony? What does she have that I don't have?
I did not carry on an affair with the cousin, and I will take a damn polygraph to that effect.
I want you to leave this house, Tony. Please. I want you to leave me alone.
TV Guide named The Sopranos the best television show in history. It's safe to say the role of Carmela made her, but Edie Falco didn't sense that at the start.
I didn't have any sense of the gravity of what we were doing. Yeah. And it might have just been because I was dumb. I didn't realize what, you know, the larger themes at play there. But I just enjoyed it. And it was still a novelty to be working on something that was good, that people enjoyed, that seemed to be well received. Yeah, that was the excitement of being on something good was still very new.
And I wonder, when you did the show, was it fun and pleasant? Was it really tough? Was it work?
No, it was fun and pleasant because there was a lighthearted atmosphere. The writing was funny. There was a lot of really funny stuff. And it was a lot of these sort of Goomba guys who were just
cutting up.
Felt like family to me and very easy to be with.
Did you participate in the writing of the kid? Did you just turn that all over? You never got involved in that?
Not at all. I was not at all interested. I had so much trust in certainly David Chase, but in all the staff that he'd carefully chosen, hand-picked. I felt like they knew what they were doing. They had a much better overview of what the story was about as opposed to what would Carmela do in here, you know?
Right.
I just thought it was a huge relief to know that I could just let them do their thing and I would do what I was hired to do. I felt completely comfortable with that.
Did they put things about you in the characters? I mean, Tina Fey, when I did 30 Rock, was someone who, the moment you told a story, there
was
some embarrassing anecdote. It was in the show.
Absolutely. Jim said that all the time. He's like, I can't talk to anybody about anything about it. It's going to be in the next episode. But I didn't notice it so much from my life. There was nothing going on in my life that was all that interesting, so I didn't see a lot of it in the scripts. But I know they, like I guess every show, to some extent, they start writing for the actors that have been hired. Like, Aida's character, Aida Turturro, who played his sister, was supposed to be a very different thing. It was supposed to be more like the mom, sort of cold and calculating and unkind. And because Aida Turturro was doing it, it sort of morphed into this whole other, like, Parvati, that phase that she went through where she was sort of like an earth child. And so, yeah, I'm sure they were writing based on what they perceived me to be, but I was not entirely cognizant of that
at the time.
Why do you think
they hired you for that part? Because you said, I read an interview where you talked about how you went and you just relaxed and said, hey, if this happens, it happens.
Right.
Which we all go through, where
sure.
You sometimes sit there and go, I can't stress about another interview.
That's right.
What do you think they hired you for?
I couldn't begin to tell you. I think probably because of that, because I was completely non-stressed. It was a script that had been bouncing around for a while, but I was doing Oz at the time, and I was working
right.
a lot,
yes.
and I kind of was all caught up in that, and it came along, and it was called Sopranos, and I thought it's about singers or something, and
right.
it's a, you know, Italian-American,
group.
Yeah,
right.
Italian-American woman, wife, and I thought I never get cast as that. I know who's going to get cast. I figured it's, you know, Annabella Shore or Marissa Tomei or some of these women who had played parts that sort of felt similar to that. There's no better place to be in when you walk into an audition than knowing you're not going to get it and not caring. So, you know, I really just sort of enjoyed myself and thought it's just another audition. And if you're in a good head, you can never not learn something from an audition. So I just went in and had fun, and you inadvertently, you present your best self when you're doing that. And I guess, I don't know, I was relaxed and I enjoyed myself. So I guess that's what they saw. I don't know.
And when you got the job, was that something that was just floored you? Were you ecstatic about getting the job?
Well, remember, so you just a pilot you get cast for, you
right.
know? So at that point, it was whatever it was, 2 weeks of work, and it was a sum of money I had never seen before, which now seems not all that shocking. But back in the day, it meant I could pay off my student loan. And so I was able to, with that one check, completely pay off my student loan. It was huge. It was a huge occurrence. But again, 2 weeks of work and then on to the next panic thing, you know, about what to do next.
And so, how soon after the pilot was shot?
I think it was a year.
Were you told? So you waited a year
yeah.
to be told this was going to move forward.
And David Chase called me and said, I just want to let you know this has been picked up. This is after we shot the pilot. And he said, well, nobody's going to watch this thing, but I'm proud of what we made or whatever. And David was also, apparently, he put his head in his hand and said, oh, no, when he found out it was picked up, because I don't think he had intended to have to tell more about these people. I think he was trying to get a movie made, and this was almost like a spec script or something.
Right.
You
this
know,
is a demo reel.
I don't think he had anticipated this going on like this. So he had his head in his hands. Jimmy's like, what am I doing? And I'm like, I can pay my student loan. And, you know, here it is 4,000 years later, and just goes to show you. You wake up every day, you have no idea what anything's going to turn into. So,
well, two things that come to mind for me. One, I probably told you this before when I would run into you, but one was I never watched TV. I just didn't have time. And I hit this period toward the last probably four seasons, definitely, maybe five. I don't want to say obsession, but my fondness for you and your character.
Hmm.
I remember I'd watch you and go, oh, my God, I've got to be married to that kind of woman who's going to stick by me through thick and thin.
That's
and
right.
make smart choices.
Right.
And she's a good partner.
Right.
Did you sense that when you were doing it?
I loved it for that reason, because it was everything that I was not, you know. I mean, it was I was a single woman living in New York, didn't have kids. And here I was ensconced in this life that I saw my grandparents live, you know. Married with kids, deeply entrenched in a community of people, family gatherings were huge, you know, everything that, and even with Jim, feeling like I was attached to a big man who would take care of stuff. It was a tremendously invigorating place to inhabit while I was working. It was completely diametrically opposed to what I lived when I left the set. And for that reason, I absolutely
loved
it.
What did you live when you left the set?
The life of a single actress in Manhattan. You know, I had a relatively small apartment. I had my dog. I had my dates. But it was not, you know, at all what other women my age, let's say in the Midwest, or certainly in my family back a number of generations.
Was everything
with
you about
with.
Work? Work was primary.
Yeah. And I loved it.
Work was your boyfriend.
It was. It
and
was.
And you dated other guys on the side.
Yes, exactly.
But work was the main
work
commitment.
It was. And I was thrilled for it. Thrilled for it. Just loved it.
How old were you when you first had a sense that you wanted to do that for a living? Seriously do it for a living?
Well, I didn't know that I could ever do it for a living. I think until I was able to do it for a living, I thought I would just do it as after my waitressing gig, you know? The idea that I could support myself with it was sort of preposterous. But my mom was an actress. She did stuff at Arena Players in Farmingdale and Broad Hollow Theater in Huntington, all around Long Island. But she had a job, and she would do her plays in the weekends and at night. And I sort of thought,
what was her job?
Many different jobs, but she was a DJ at WGLI, was a station on Long Island. She was a copywriter, and she did a million different things. She decided she wanted a job, and she would get it. But then at night, she'd do her plays, and I thought that's what you do when you want to be an actor.
How many siblings do you have?
I've got an older brother, younger brother, and a younger sister.
That's four.
four of us all told, yes.
And were any of them also interested in the theater?
Not at all.
Even though your mother was an actress, yeah. A legit actress. And your father was a
painter, artist. And he was a musician for when he was younger, but then he went on to do sculpture and painting. And
your parents got divorced when you were how old?
I have no idea. Because they got divorced, and then they remarried each other two other times. So it was a very complicated childhood with that
stuff.
Oh,
they remarried each other?
Yes, yeah, and then divorced and remarried and divorced. And I don't even know what they are right now.
So if you don't mind my asking, because I want to make a movie out of this, actually.
Oh, God.
I want to play this. They got divorced, and when they would get divorced, how long were they apart before they reunited? A matter of months?
No, longer. It was for the first time was a number of years. And, you know, they kind of, the kids were pitted against each other. And then we found out that parents were sort of hanging out with each other again. It was... you know, horrifying for the kids that they would suddenly get together again and then they would have a ceremony and we would witness their wedding. It was, you know, I don't know, led to some psychological issues that I'm working on as we speak. But
we'll
yeah.
get to that. We'll
yeah,
get
all
to
right.
that. And none of your siblings had the bug.
Not at all. Not, I mean,
and how did
quite
you
the opposite.
And so did this become formal for you only when you go to purchase, or had you done plays before you went to school?
Community theater plays, nothing too, and school plays, you know, but nothing very serious. And then I went to purchase first as a liberal arts person. And I saw some actor friends had gone into purchase in the program, and I thought I really wanted
program,
to be there.
And that program had grown.
Yes, each
and
year.
And now it's become this very estimable program
yeah.
on the East Coast.
Yeah.
Big time.
So I auditioned and went the next year as an acting student.
And did you graduate? Did you finish?
I did.
And then when you finished, what did you do?
Well, do you remember the League auditions, that uh-huh. whole thing? So we had the League auditions, and from those auditions, I got a part in a movie where I had to be on set the day after I graduated, and I thought, you know, what's everybody talking about? This is so easy. I just kind of glided my way into this career. I didn't do anything for 5-plus years after that, but did a movie called Sweet Lorraine that was done up in the Catskills with the guy's name was Steve Gomer, the director.
How did that go?
It was
did it drive you
dreamy.
Forward?
It sure did. Well, it was. I couldn't believe I was on a movie set. You know, it was a huge thing. And I had just graduated from school, and it was crazily exciting. You know, what the heck were we? Like 8 weeks up in the Catskills, I think it was, and kind of fell in love with all the boys in the show. You know, it was like being a sleepaway camp. And I remember when my agent said, I hope you're sitting down. You booked that movie. And you're going to get paid more money than you have ever seen in your life. They're going to pay you $2,000 a week, which was more money than I had ever seen in my life.
Had you been waitressing?
Not yet. No, except on Long Island. I hadn't really had
right
to.
Right out of purchase, you got
right
the movie.
Right out of purchase.
So it was after the movie, the waitressing began.
Oh, yes.
To try to keep up that $2,000 a week
That's
income.
That's right. Hey,
you work at the Rainbow Room.
I was living
you
were
at the champagne counter
exactly
at the Rainbow
right.
Room.
That's exactly right. Thinking it would be consistent, yes, but no.
What was the job for you that ended that? Like, when did you get a job and then you never went back again? You only made a living as an actress.
I was waitressing at a place called Canyon Road on 77th and 1st. It was the last waitressing job I had. I worked there with Paul Schulze, my friend, who has actually been on a bunch of my shows with me, my great actor friend. And he was bartending, and I went off to do a thing called Cost of Living, a low-budget independent thing. And I left, and I was about to come back to the restaurant job, and I just had one of those sort of grace moments where I thought, no, I'm not going to come back. I don't know how this is going to work, but I'm not going to waitress anymore. It was a total leap of faith.
I'm going to be homeless.
Didn't have a plan.
I'm going to live in a wash machine box.
Which seemed
I picked out the box.
Preferable to taking another order at that restaurant, so I couldn't do it anymore. So, yeah, and at that, I don't know, I guess Oz happened shortly after
talk
that, maybe.
About that. So what was the experience like working with Fontana?
You know Tom, right?
I met him a couple
forget.
Times.
Yeah. I love him. He was one of those angel guys, you know, because I had done a movie called Laws of Gravity, and it got some attention. It played the sort of Sundance and the festival circuit. Tom saw it and decided he wanted to use me for stuff, and so he put me in a series called Firehouse about EMT workers and fire people or whatever. Then he cast me in Homicide, or maybe it was the other way around. He kept putting me in stuff when I wasn't really working much, and then he said, I'm doing the series about a prison. I have two parts. You can play the nun or you can play the correction officer. Which part do you want to play? I said, I'll be the correction officer. And that was, you know, he just decided he was going to take care of me. And he did. And he did for many years.
You were in his troupe.
I was in his
acting
troupe. Yeah. And I was just
how many seasons did you do?
Of Oz?
Yeah.
Gosh, you know, I have no idea, actually, come to think of it.
More than a couple?
Yeah. I was just so crazy grateful for the work. And I remember, it was before cell phones. I remember Terry Kinney was on the show with me, and he was the first person I ever knew who had his own phone. I just thought he was the coolest thing going. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. It was fun. It was really, really fun. And it was great to have a steady gig.
And then after that, what did you do? How long between that and The Sopranos?
Not long. I was doing, Oz.
Frankie and Johnny?
That was during Sopranos. I think that was during two seasons of Sopranos. But I was doing Oz, and then I was doing Sideman, right, play that I did for a very long time.
Sure.
And I was doing Oz at night and Sideman during the day, and then Sopranos came in. And so I was doing, there was a period of time where I was doing sort of all three of them. And I thought, because they were so great and I couldn't say no to anything, but I was very unhappy because I was exhausted and sick most of the time, screaming my voice out. And it was an embarrassment of riches, but I might have done better to say no to one of them. But be that as it may, it was at a time when I couldn't imagine not doing any of those jobs.
Yeah.
Hello?
Well, I'm trying to think of how to say this. I'm going to write a book. I'm writing a memoir that's coming out in a year. And in the book, I've got some interesting things I talk about. And one of which was I celebrated my 30th anniversary.
Nice.
In February 23rd of this year. I went out to Los Angeles, which was the scene of the crime for me.
Is that right?
And can we talk about that?
Yeah, of course.
Are you on the record about that?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. I was wondering how that affected your career.
Well, I got sober 23 years ago, and there was really not much of anything going on at the time, and I'm grateful for that. Also because, you know, the access people have to your life nowadays. I'm just glad there none of that was going on. Nobody was interested back when I was a mess. So I was able to get kind of squared with a lot of that stuff
before you stepped into the spotlight.
Yeah, before anything big was happening in my life.
And me
too. So I was very, very grateful for the timing of all that.
And when you walk into a room in AA, there's not a lot of people who have 25 years.
Yeah, that's right.
Not many people make it that far.
Yeah.
I mean, there might be, when they do the hand-raising thing, I'm in a room the other day in LA where there was 300 people, and there might have been like 6 or 8 of them that had over 20 years.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah. We're the old timers now.
Right. Yeah, right. We're the old timers.
Right.
Now. Is there still a part of your life?
I go on my anniversary, which was last week, and just to announce it. I'm a Buddhist, which is what I do now.
You are.
I spend a great deal of time at a Buddhist center in New York where it has given my life a tremendous amount of
richness. Don't mind, I ask you, when did that enter into your life? Because you're not the first person I know who has supplanted sobriety.
Interesting.
And 12-step sobriety with Buddhism a Buddhist type of—
There are a lot of crossovers. I see a lot of people that I know from both places.
So I see.
Yeah. Like 20-something years ago, I inadvertently ran into a meditation class, and it was this teacher, and then I kind of wandered away, and then I kind of went back, and it was the same teacher. I thought I was going to some other thing. This happened a number of times. And then a good 5 or 6 years ago, I went back again, and here's the same darn teacher in a different place. And I've been going consistently for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years, as much as I can. It feeds me in a huge way.
How so? What do you get out of it?
Well, it's not just sort of mumbo-jumbo spiritual kind of. It's like a science of the mind, really, that was established 2,500 years ago. And so they've got history on their side. And I see the people who spend a good deal of time there and the teacher there, they have what I want, you know, the stick with the winners thing. That I love AA, but, you know, there are a lot of cuckoos in there. You know, and I love them because I understand them. But to be in a place where there's somebody who really has something that I want is very meaningful to me. It becomes harder and harder to find that. That's huge, though.
And for you, what I'm wondering, what did it give you? What did it help you deal with or manage?
Well, single parenting is not for the faint of heart, shall I say. You know, you live for 40 years where you're the center of your universe. You know, when you want to get a massage, you go get one. And as you know, that kids enter the picture and it turns your whole life. I mean, there's nothing recognizable about it. And it was really a crash course in not being the center of my universe anymore. So, and I didn't always handle it great. I spent a fair amount of time just not being okay with the fact that I couldn't control my environment. So a lot of it is about remaining calm, about being patient, about remembering what's important, about patience is I think the biggest part of it. I have a short temper that people may not believe, but you know, in my home environment, it's not pretty. So it has helped me immeasurably with that.
Describe your son.
Cute.
Lovable.
He's lovable and blonde. He's spectacularly amazing kid, and he's been through a lot, and he has some learning stuff, and also ADD, ADHD, and all those acronyms, which, you know, single parenting under the best of circumstances is difficult, but when you have a kid who's bouncing off the walls and then a kid who's not, who's getting beat up by the kid who's bouncing off the walls, it's complicated and it's
difficult. So the little one
difficult.
Is.
Yeah, she's the sort of the survivor.
Recipient.
Yes, yes.
The receptacle. All that energy.
So, but, you know, she's a tough kid. She can take care of herself.
Come on over here. Let's play sword fight.
Yeah, no, you're the sword. And he's constantly beating the crap out of her. And she's learned to kind of make the best of it. But the fact that she has to is what is a drag. So, but, you know, we all had our stuff growing up in the middle child. And, you know, everybody, we all have some order in which we were born and the difficulties we had and being the first one or the last one or whatever. And my kids' challenges are not that unusual, but, you know.
I say to my daughter, my older daughter, I've said to her recently, I said to her, you know, to me, a God or the presence of some kind of force like that in your life manifests itself in the instincts that you have. And I said to her, the minute you get into trouble in this life, in my experience, is when you stop listening to your instincts.
Mm-hmm.
That's all we can do is try to get them to listen to that voice in them.
Because mm-hmm.
in the end, they're going to do what they're going to do.
That's right.
We can't make them do what we want to do. It's painful.
Boy.
It's painful.
Shocking, too. I mean, especially in this industry, we have so many people running around, you know, telling you how great you are and, you know, making sure that your every need is taken care of. And then you go home and your kids just couldn't care less.
Your kids have no idea
what
who
you're
you
asking.
Are.
They do, but I think they think everybody's parents have some kind of life like this. I don't know. They're exceedingly unimpressed. But, just to hang up the damn coat, you know what I mean? They just couldn't possibly care less the way I want the house to look and, you know, all that stuff that used to be so important that I'm learning slowly to let go of.
There's a humanness to Edie Falco's characters. No matter how tough their exterior appears, her women are vulnerable, fallible, and we can't get enough of them. This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing from WNYC Studios, produced by Emily Botine and Kathy Russo, with Melanie Hoops, Ed Herbstman, Zach McNeese, Dan O'Donnell, Krista Ripple, Joel Werner, and Mallory Schwartz. Here's the Thing is produced in association with Eldorado Pictures.